Possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We've seen some very cold temperatures and dangerous wind chill readings this winter, so we bundle up to face the elements or stay inside where the furnace keeps the chill at bay. But how do animals manage? We take up that question this afternoon with biologist, writer, and illustrator Bernd Heinrich, professor of biology at the University of Vermont. He is the author of numerous books, including Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival. And this winter world is a world of wonder. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival, Bernd Heinrich's previous books include the award-winning Mind of the Raven and Bumblebee Economics, which was twice nominated for the National Book Award. Winter World, by the way, is just out in a paperback edition from Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. 333-9455-800-222-9455. Mr. Heinrich, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Celeste. Nice to be here.
How is the weather where you are today?
Well, we got blue skies, but we just had snow last night, about 6 inches, and we got some more coming here in a couple of days. It's been like that every few days.
Yeah, well, we're getting more tomorrow. We're under a winter storm watch.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a fair amount of snow this year, and, you know, each snow has been so different.
Yeah.
From snow that is so light and fluffy that the people who measure snowfall for the record have had a hard time hanging on to it to make the measurement in the wind. Then, you know, there's been a snowfall of the kind that kids love for snowballs and snowmen, but adults just hate the shovel.
Yeah, a lot of work.
There's a lot of difference in snowflakes and in the types of snows that fall. You want to talk with us about that?
Well, certainly it's important for shelter for many animals. I mean, here in New England, for especially the grouse, for example, they would dive into the snow, so they like really fluffy snow. But it's got to be able to have some structure to it so that they can make a cave, snow cave.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other animals that, you know, especially the small mammals and the shrews and insects that are sheltered under the snow, and they have tunnels there, and so they have regular little highways where they live, and which is important for it to protect them from the very low temperatures that we've been having here. I don't know about out there in Urbana, but we've had down to about minus 30 here.
Oh, no, it hasn't been that cold.
No.
It's been down below zero, maybe 7 below has been the lowest we've hit so far. From all appearance, you write in this book, Winter World, many northern birds get excited by snow, especially the first snowstorm of the year. What have you observed? How do they show this excitement?
Well, I've watched ravens a lot, and they especially seem to be excited by snow. They bathe in it, they roll around in it. It's like a place where they can just really have a good time. They just kind of just amazing, like puppies, you know, like dogs will just slide, and otters will slide on the snow. I guess there are a number of other birds besides ravens, but ravens are the most playful with respect to snow.
So they're actually like romping through the snow.
Yeah, they enjoy it just like kids do.
Oh.
It's all great as long as you're well insulated and warm. But if you're not, of course, then it's not so much fun.
Right. Well, they can't go shopping at L.L. Bean.
No.
They've got to have what they need on their backs from the get-go.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this tiny, tiny bird that you write quite a bit about. Uh-huh. From the, you mentioned the raven, but now this is an
right.
entirely different kind of bird, the right. kinglet.
Yeah. Well, the kinglet is a little insect-eating bird, and it lives primarily in the coniferous forest. I don't know if there would be any around Urbana. Probably not. And they are amazing in that most insectivorous birds, of course, they fly south in the wintertime because you can't catch flies and things. The few exceptions who eat insects, such as woodpeckers who hammer into wood to get their grubs and chickadees can pry under bark and so on. So these are amazing in the sense that they find enough food, and in the wintertime you especially need a lot of food to produce a lot of heat in order to keep warm, and also the fact that they're so small, and the smaller the body, the more readily it loses heat to the environment, so the larger the surface area. So these little guys should be cooling very, very rapidly unless you're producing a lot of heat to counteract that heat loss. And so I felt they are rather amazing in that they can stand temperatures down to minus 30. I mean, you go out on after a night where you go out and your hand turns stiff in seconds and it's cold, and here they are, you know, all day and all night long. So that's why I thought they were really kind of iconic of the wonder of survival in the wintertime.
Yeah. How small are they?
Well, they weigh about 5 or 6 grams, a couple of penny weight.
That's tiny.
Very tiny, yes. They're you know, not too much bigger than hummingbirds.
Hmm.
Yeah, and most people don't see them very easily because they're in dense conifers and very inobtrusive and very kind of bland colors, except that they have... They're called kinglet because they have a crown on the head of light feathers, gold feathers, golden crown kinglet, and the males have in the middle of that gold crown also a flaming orange that they can shoot up with the feathers that they can erect.
Hmm. What is its song like?
Oh, it's very high pitched and. I mean, I can't mimic
you.
I'm sorry, but it's a beautiful little ditty that you hear early in the spring, and especially when it reminds you of, you know, what they've just been through the wintertime and survived all of that, and so I really like to hear it a lot.
Yeah, boy, we think we're happy to see the spring. Those
yeah.
guys got to be really pleased
right.
when it warms up.
Yeah.
You know, this little bird, it can endure temperatures to 30 degrees below zero. Does a bird like this is it ever in danger of the kind of thing that we're susceptible to, frostbite, hypothermia?
I would think so. Well, the thing is, they have a huge mortality. They have a very high reproductive rate, and I think it's estimated about 85% of the population on average would die out during the winter. So, you know, they are on the edge, and they don't all make it. And but they have a high reproductive rate to compensate for that. So, you know, if they don't find the exact right spot, and it's a very cold and very windy night, and they're not very well sheltered, and they haven't had a good day foraging, boom, that might be the end of them. Once they get too hypothermic, once they drop their body temperature too much, they would start to probably lose control of it, and then they could freeze solid in a very, very short time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they are walking on a tightrope there, especially with respect to energy resources, because most birds, if they have plenty of food, then they can still shiver just more vigorously. In fact, they shiver and they expend energy at about the rate they do in flight at the maximum. So they can produce a lot of heat. But as soon as you run out of fuel, boom, that's it. That's the end.
Yeah, and they
unless they have some, you know, who can conserve some of their energy resources by shutting down, by lowering the thermostat, and that way they can make the food resources last longer. But then there's a danger of losing control.
Yeah, and this little bird, the kinglet, as you mentioned, it has a pretty high body temperature, so it keeps to keep warm, and it takes a lot to fuel that.
Yes. And so that's the interesting thing, that here's an animal that at first glance you might think it has no visible means of support because it feeds on insects in the wintertime when all the insects are in hibernation. And you can go out there in the woods a long time and look for insects and you have a hard time to find any at all. And they never come to feeders. They're not like chickadees who will eat your sunflower seeds. So they have this problem.
Yeah. How do they go about locating dinner then?
Well, this is one thing I've been really really wondered about. And you see them picking on branches a lot, but I haven't actually seen them picking up anything. So you know, it's really wasn't known until we found that they were picking little tiny caterpillars, inchworm caterpillars, that are camouflaged and they're frozen to the branches. And they look just, these little caterpillars, they look like little withered spruce and fir needles almost. And by hitting the trees, banging on the trees, you can sometimes dislodge some of them and find them on the snow and have to pick them out among the debris. And so you can find, so they are there. And apparently they must have extremely good eyesight, at least up close, to find these things.
Yeah. You know, some animals, it seems to me, are really, they've got it right, I think. And that
right.
Given that they're outside in these conditions, they hibernate. They sleep through
right.
Winter.
Right.
The groundhog hibernates. Poor Phil was pulled out of his burrow in the midst of his
mm-hmm.
nap on Monday.
I didn't see that, but I believe it.
Bears hibernate. What are some of the other species that cope with winter by sleeping through it?
Hibernation is something that basically all animals do who don't have enough food resources and who can't migrate. So, for example, in the squirrels, I mean, the groundhog is basically a ground squirrel. And the tree squirrels, such as the gray squirrels, don't hibernate, and they feed on buds up in the trees, and so they have a food supply, and so they don't hibernate. Chipmunk hibernates some of the time, and some of the time is awake, and it can stay awake due to the fact that it can store nuts and seeds in its underground burrows, so it can store some of the food. And a woodchuck can store grass and green stuff that it feeds on, your lettuce and so on, in the wintertime. So it stores energy in its fat, in its body fat. But there's a limit to how fat you can get, and so it has to conserve what it does have by lowering its body temperature, and it can only do that if it has a safe den to hang out in, so it can burrow into the ground. You know, birds can't do that, so they really don't have that option. So, you know, different animals just have different options, different possibilities, and they have exploited those. Some flying squirrels, for example, will huddle and thereby conserve energy resources, huddle in a dense nest that they make, a very insulated nest where they keep warm. I've seen up to 10 flying squirrels in a single nest, and they were not hibernating, but they were keeping warm because there's so many of them together.
Yeah. You write in this book that probably the most remarkable story of hibernation and winter survival of any mammal is the Arctic ground squirrel. What's his story?
Well, Arctic ground squirrels are sort of the Arctic woodchucks. I mean, they're sort of, it looks sort of like a woodchuck, and a little bit smaller, but they're also ground squirrel, and they are amazing in the sense that they can cool down to temperature of near 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the freezing point of water, and sometimes even a little bit below that. And then they can warm up again after that, so they've still got the ability to come out of that torpor by starting to shiver. For example, if you cooled a lab rat down, it might still be alive, but it would never warm up again on its own. The amazing thing about these Arctic squirrels is that they warm up spontaneously several times in the wintertime. And so people have wondered for a long time, so why do they bother to wake up in the middle of the winter when it costs a lot of energy? You're going to burn off a lot of fat by shivering to stay warm. And then it looked like after they'd warmed up, they went to sleep. So anyways, one hypothesis is that that they're actually warming up in order to sleep. Now, that sounds contradictory. So it turns out that when you sleep, your brain is rather active. We all dream, and so there are things going on with the brain when we're asleep, and we require sleep. And so it appears to be that in order to have those biochemical processes occurring, the body temperature needs to be high enough. So apparently they repair something in the brain when they wake up periodically and do this sleeping too. So we don't really know what it is, you know, that sleeping really does. But if you are totally out cold and your temperature is really, really low, you can't do this active process.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, it is very difficult for me to go to sleep if my feet are cold. Or I'm going to wake up if the blanket falls on the floor.
Exactly, right. That's the interesting part, that these animals cool down and are, you know, comfortable. They have to feel comfortable. They allow themselves to cool down. So in other words, they don't feel the cold like we do. To them, it's just something that they do, and they probably feel good about it because they allow themselves to do it. They don't fight it.
Very interesting. Bernd Heinrich is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a biologist, writer, and illustrator, professor of biology at the University of Vermont. We're talking with him about his book, Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go first to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I have been keeping water available for the birds and squirrels this winter, and they certainly make major use of it. Sometimes I have to refill it about every 15 minutes. What do the rabbits do for water when there's no snow on the ground?
Well, rabbits would be eating probably buds and twigs, and they would, first of all, have a lot of water in there. I don't know specifically what rabbits do, but, you know, I've seen many birds eat water or eat snow, which is essentially the same as drinking water. I mean, just watch yesterday my ravens, they were out there, you know, snapping up snow, and we've got a bunch of red poles near the feeder, and I saw them eating snow, too. So,
well, that I figured they did do, but I just didn't know when we had a snowless winter and it's cold, how they managed to get any...
A snowless winter, yeah. There are animals that live in our deserts, for example, in the very hottest deserts, and they never drink their entire life, ever.
Wow.
Many rodents, for example.
The kangaroo rat.
Kangaroo rat, that's right. So it all depends on the diet. For example, if you eat a lot of protein, then you need to drink a lot of water to get rid of the nitrogenous waste product, your urea, which is poisonous waste product. But you can convert the, it essentially comes from the amino groups from protein, and is originally ammonia, which is very poisonous. You can convert it into uric acid, which is very not poisonous at all, but and can excrete it with very little water, or else you have to blow it out with a lot of water if you had ammonia, for example. So, but if you didn't have protein, you wouldn't have these nitrogenous waste products, and you can get by with very little. For example, a bear goes all winter long without drinking at all. And in part, that's due to the fact that it's burning, that the bear is burning fat, which where you really only have, you have water as a byproduct
right.
of metabolism, and no protein. So unless it starts switching over to protein metabolism, it doesn't have to drink and it doesn't have to urinate.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I would imagine also like a rabbit might munch into tender trees and shrubs, and
right.
as you mentioned, they might eat the foliage or the buds.
Right.
But it seems to me that some of our tender young trees might be susceptible to being munched on
right.
through the winter by rabbits.
Well, they certainly are. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, they will. Have them around the cabin in Maine, and you put a fruit tree out, they will girdle it pretty quick.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller. Listener in Muhammad, line two. Hi.
Hi. I enjoyed your first book, by the way, your book about ravens, rather.
Uh-huh.
And I had two questions, One was, can you tell me about the sleeping arrangements of our own sort of brown or red squirrels around here?
I didn't catch that.
Well, do the brown squirrels, in their nest, they sleep together in nests, or all?
Do the ground squirrels sleep together in nests?
No, not ground squirrels either. I think of them as tree squirrels.
Tree squirrels?
They're the ones that have nests in the trees.
Oh, yes, they do, yes. I have, for example, a couple. There are three gray squirrels, for example, right now in a nest close to our window, and I can see them every day going in there. There's three of them.
Ah, okay.
So I'm not sure exactly if that's a mother with a couple of the young or what, but yeah.
So the sharing nest is how they keep warm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And another question is, when your book about ravens,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering to what extent, if you see one raven flying one direction and one flying another direction,
mm-hmm.
they obviously have a place they are in mind of going, but it seems like is one responding to one set of stimuli and another to another, or to the extent, what extent do they sort of have volition, do you think?
Birds will often, ravens, you can see them flying long, long distance in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect, they're going to a roost, or they're going to a feeding place, and they have different roosts and different feeding places, so one of the reasons they're flying in a different direction. This might be just searching around. I would say, volition is a good way to describe it. If they're going to a place where they've been before that they know about and go there directly.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating subject. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener on the toll-free line, line 4, Belgium. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Interesting you mentioned ravens. Now, I'm not exactly sure if what I'm going to talk about is exactly a raven, not knowing the exact definition. Where I'm located at is along the Vermilion River. And over here in the east-central portion of Illinois, we have a lot of ravens, thousands upon thousands of them. They seem to have a roost here mm-hmm. during the winter.
Well, I think you're probably talking about crows.
Okay, it must be. That's what I was going to say. Those are different from ravens, huh?
Right.
I see, because they're in huge numbers.
Right. I mean, here in the east and the central and in the central states, you would, especially around Illinois, you have large flocks, large roosts, and sometimes a number in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and there have been some reported in Oklahoma, I think, up to a million or more.
Well, the ones we have are enough that they break trees.
Break trees?
Oh, yes.
Holy
they'll get on limbs, so many of them, and a tree will uh-huh. break sometimes.
Yeah, well, I don't think ravens, most of the roosts I've seen are, like 50 or 100 And in the western states, there are some up to 1,000 or a couple of thousand, but that's about it.
I see.
But so I'm almost certain that you're talking about the American crow.
Okay, they're smaller than the raven also.
Yeah, about one-third the weight.
I see. They seem to love the snow. They stay right at the very edge. In the winter, they'll move up and down. If there's too much snow, you see them move away from here, and they won't stay here. And then when the snow disappears or starts getting away, they'll come back in.
Right. The roots kind of change location with availabilities of food. Mm. So generally, we have that many birds around. You've got to have a source of food.
And sure.
If there's no food around, they'll eventually leave.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Ravens are fascinating. I remember once coming across one, or it coming across me, on a hike, and the sound of its wings are just incredible.
Right. That's one good way to tell the ravens apart from the crow. You don't hear the crows making those whoosh, 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 whoosh,
yeah.
whoosh, really loud wing beats.
And you, I don't know if you've seen the Charles Adams cartoon where there's a woman running down the beach and there's a shadow of this huge bird and her husband's presumably is in the grip of this huge bird, and she's saying, George, drop the keys. But it's huge. I mean, it's the sound of that raven was so incredible. I could almost feel like, could this could this animal that's coming up behind me pick me up, carry me away? Of course not, but they're so large.
Yeah, they are pretty impressive birds.
Yeah. Speaking of impressive birds, hawks are awfully impressive birds. And not long ago, I came out of the house, and there was a hawk sitting in a tree. And this summer, we had a huge number of small birds in the backyard.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed that lately they've moved out. It seems that the hawk has moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And at least temporarily, the birds are gone.
Right.
And, you know, cover, of course, is not as abundant at this point in the year.
Mm-hmm.
What do birds and other small animals do at this time of year to stay out of the way of a bird like the hawk?
Well, they certainly seek denser cover. I mean, we have a lot of chickadees and red poles coming to the feeder. And again, we had a Cooper's hawk come by a couple of weeks ago, and all the birds cleared out.
Mm-hmm.
And when they feed, they go to the densest branches. I mean, the chickadees will grab a seed and then fly into a kind of a thicket to chop it open, peck it open and eat. So, so the attractiveness of a feeder is definitely also related to the availability of cover right near it, because they're quite vulnerable when they're feeding.
Mm-hmm. So put the feeder near the pine trees, for example.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm curious about what happens to robins if they stay north in the cold weather. I know that many of them, or most of them, migrate, but those that don't, do you know, have any idea what mortality is or how they persist?
I don't know what the mortality is, but I have noticed some years, even some staying here all winter in Maine and Vermont, New Hampshire, occasionally see some. I see them when they come back. There are berries like viburnum bushes, and here on campus at the University of Vermont, they feed on the ornamental apples, the little crab apple types.
Mm-hmm.
They feed on fruit, so that's what sustains them, is fruit.
I see. I have another little question. The birds have extremely thin legs, limbs, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering how they maintain those things without freezing when the temperatures get very low. Is it just the circulation is...
Right, that's a good question. They certainly don't, they keep their feet, if they kept their feet at the same temperature as the rest of the body, they would be...
Lose too much heat.
They would just starve to death very quickly, probably, on a cold night. They'd lose all their food energy. They have to shiver all the time to replace that heat. So what they do is, First of all, they have countercurrent heat exchanges, which have blood vessels going up and down the leg, touching each other, so that the heat so that the blood that returns to the body picks up the heat that would otherwise go down into the feet.
Right.
So it recovers the heat, so it can have still circulation, and keep the feet cool. So they're trying to keep the feet cold to conserve energy, but of course they can't let their feet get too cold, or else they'll freeze. So they have
right.
to keep them at least above the freezing point of the tissues.
Yeah.
So that's the temperature then that they're regulated at.
Yeah, it seems to me remarkable that they can do that with such thin.
Yes, it is remarkable,
thin covering.
It's just amazing because I go out here at minus 20 degrees, for example, and my hands instantly kind of clam. I can't move hardly. It's just really cold. And here, these little tiny kinglets and chickadees, for example, with these little matchstick legs are smaller, and they're still flexible. Of course, most of their muscles up in the upper part of their leg under the feathers.
Right.
So they're just the tendons going down there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Also, if you get past the feathers, the size of their feet seem to make a whole lot more sense. Do you know what I'm saying?
The size of their feet?
Yeah, that their legs are so thin,
uh-huh.
and that their feet are relatively small, because the feathers are so plump. They give them a lot of insulation, of course.
Right.
Yeah. With the leaves off the trees now, we can see nests, birds constructed in the warm weather.
Mm-hmm.
But the birds, as far as I've been able to observe, they don't hang out in those nests in the wintertime at all.
No, they don't.
Is that because the nests are inadequate shelters in winter?
They're inadequate. I mean, they're built specifically for raising young,
mm-hmm.
for raising the young. So they're, for the most part, kind of cup-shaped. There are only a few birds that will have a covered nest, like wrens, with a little hole on the side, but most of them are open.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're built to last only for the most part, you know, a couple of weeks or so while they're raising the young. But they still, for example, woodpeckers and nuthatches will go into nest holes. I mean, woodpeckers and nuthatches, for example, drill holes into trees
mm-hmm.
For their nests, and so the nest is inside the hole, and they seek those same shelters in the wintertime for keeping warm.
Oh, very interesting. In this book, Winter World, there's an essay where you're going on a walk in the woods in winter, and it's so surprising that so much is going on, and there are insects out and about, snow fleas and spiders and a caterpillar.
Mm.
Now, these animals have no fur or feathers,
mm.
so how are they making their way through winter?
Mm. Well, I described the caterpillar, which was actually already in kind of very early spring when temperatures were above the freezing point. It was walking on the snow. But most of the caterpillars will be in an inactive state,
mm-hmm.
most of the insects, spiders
mm-hmm.
as well. Snow fleas are an exception who come out sometimes. But basically they have either of two main strategies, and one is to have antifreezes, which lower the freezing point so that they stay in the tissue, stay in the liquid state. And one of the downsides of that is that it inhibits their metabolism, and so, you know, they're kind of like alcohol, they're just pickled, and if they're pickled full of glycerol or something, they can't really be active. And others, there are a few who actually tolerate being frozen, having ice in their tissues, so that they would, you know, feel solid. And there are several frogs that can do that as well, can survive freezing.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes special physiological tricks to be able to do that.
Boy, the variety is really breathtaking, isn't it?
Yes. That's what makes it really fascinating, because there's so many different ways of getting by, and each kind of tailor-made to specific situations.
Yeah. And I'm recalling now something that you say in the introduction to this book, that by watching and thinking about this variety and how all these animals are coping, we can, I think as you put it, we can see the unimaginable.
Yeah, I mean, because it's pretty hard to imagine some of these things,
mm-hmm.
unless you actually see it. I mean, it's not things that you would really predict.
Stranger than fiction.
Right. Because we kind of look from our own perspectives, and this is what we do,
mm-hmm.
and then we see some other animal do something totally different, and we just can't imagine it because we see it from our own perspective.
Yeah. This creature called the snow flea, I was totally unaware there was such an insect.
Uh-huh.
Sounds pretty interesting to me,
uh-huh.
that animals might be just as afflicted with fleas in the wintertime as they are in the summertime. And, you know, in the summertime, you'll see birds trying to deal with mites and uh-huh. whatever is bugging them, living on them. But in the wintertime, how do hosts cope with what I would imagine would be quite an irritating situation?
Well, there are, you know, ectoparasites that live on animals in the wintertime, and they essentially have it real easy, those parasites.
I mean,
in fact, there's some flies that live on birds. They're specifically adapted to crawl under the feathers of the bird, and they keep nice and warm all winter long, so they've got it made. And, you know, fleas as well. They have a nice, warm environment under the fur of the mouse or squirrel. But I think what you were referring to in snow fleas is something entirely different.
Oh, okay.
So the snow fleas are... Fleas is a very poor word for these guys.
Uh-huh.
They are not anywhere near related to fleas. They are totally... different group of animals, and in fact, you know, fleas are evolved from flying insects, but the snow fleas are don't look like regular insects. They, if you looked at them under the microscope, you would see they have kind of a tail that is curled up under their belly, and it's solid, and it hitches into a little notch, and then when it when they provide pressure, they can make it fling that tail out, and if it's against the substrate, it makes them fly. So they're jumping with their tail, essentially, or a tail-like appendage, just a single appendage that flings them away. So that's what makes them look like fleas. Unless you've got a microscope, you see them flipping around, and it looks like they're fleas hopping, but fleas hop with using their two hind legs, and this only uses their tail. These guys use their tail, and they what they feed on is probably bacteria and detritus underneath the snow.
Mm-hmm.
And once in a while, when the snow surface temperature starting to melt a little bit, they'll often come out through the snow or along the edges, and you see them in huge crowds of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and sometimes even make the snow almost look black in places. And I'm not exactly sure why they do this.
Hmm. Boy, there's a lot of riddles out there, a lot of mysteries. But in the meantime, those fleas that are true fleas,
uh-huh.
who are having the good life,
uh-huh.
in the wintertime, how do their hosts try and... I mean, I think fleas are quite unpleasant. And,
right. Well, they're unpleasant
for the animals,
winter,
too.
Summer as well. So
yeah.
I think, you know, the problem hasn't changed too much in the wintertime.
Do animals use snow to get at the problem?
Mm. Well, I have never seen it. I kind of doubt it.
Okay.
But some of these ectoparasites are, you know, very harmful. For example, here in the Northeast, there are ticks that attack moose, for example, and they are a big problem because they multiply in the wintertime if it's not too cold. If it gets really, really cold, then the skin surface is cold enough and they die off. But if it's not that cold, then they seem to multiply. And then they itch a lot, and the moose will rub their fur and end up scraping off a lot of their fur, and then they run into energy problems because of too much heat loss, et cetera, and blood loss. So there's actually a lot of mortality due to these ticks. I haven't heard of mortality from fleas directly.
Yeah. Well, we're having a winter here that's been colder than the last several, so we're complaining. But there are these swings in temperature and snow cover from one winter to the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the animals have to be adapted to the worst.
Yeah. So, and also, while this winter has been relatively cold, you know, we're told that we humans are inducing climate change with the climate getting warmer.
Right.
What would you like to tell us? What would you like to say about how global warming might affect animals or is affecting animals?
Well, it's already affecting the ranges of many animals. I mean, it's documented all over the place that more southerly animals are coming north. I mean, here, for example, in New England, we now have cardinals and tufted titmice, which I'd never seen before. Sometimes the crows are starting to stay over in the winter, whereas before they always went away, and you never saw them until April. So, on the other hand, more northerly adapted ones, some actually require snow, such as hares who turn white and they have to have snow, and some require to be kind of kept cold under the snow through the winter. So all of these animals would change their ranges. They would locally become extinct and move. So, range change is one of the biggest, in many places they might then be extirpated if they can't move.
Yeah, and I would imagine that could lead to changes in the ecology of a range.
Well, certainly, yes.
Yeah. Any white-winged crossbills your way this winter?
We have seen a few, and they only come every, occasionally.
Uh-huh.
So I was happy to see some this year. Maybe it's because we had lots of snow and cold, I don't know. But mostly it's because we had some seeds of the red spruce. So, they follow the seeds. And so they're heavily dependent on what the seed crops are. And
apparently that's why so many robins have stayed here this winter, as we had a good crop of berries and seeds and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah. Here we now have a leaf beetle that has invaded, and it's killing a lot of the viburnums. And the viburnums are one of the main berry crops in the winter. And in fact, the berry crop, there were, hundreds and hundreds of pounds in the bog next to our house in the last few years. But now, this last year, there weren't any. And this leaf beetle has been introduced in only, less than 10 years ago. And it's now all over the place. And it might kind of obliterate all of the viburnum bushes. So it's going to have a huge effect on the bird populations, I imagine.
Mm. One last question before we have to wrap up here, and it's very practical. As a fellow who likes to walk in the woods in the winter time, how do you keep warm and dry? What's your advice?
Well, I wear lots of layers, and I think my feet and my hands are the most vulnerable, and so I have loose boots, nice wool socks, and just basically common sense. It's not that hard. if you just have a number of layers, and you can always peel off.
Yeah, and stay out of the wet.
Stay out of the wet, mainly. Yeah. Don't ever get wet.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you very much. I have too.
You're very welcome. Bernd Heinrich is our guest, has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a biologist, writer, and illustrator, professor of biology at the University of Vermont. He's the author of numerous books, including Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival. This book is just out in a paperback edition from Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Chicago, pretty interesting today, actually, at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Both the feeder cattle and live cattle down the limits, Celeste, at the Board of Trade or at the Mercantile Exchange. That on some comments made out of Washington, one about potential for a couple more cases of BSE to show up in the U.S. at some point in the future, not saying that they're there, but that they might show up, and also that an international panel looking into BSE and what the United States ought to do to protect itself and the rest of society around the world, suggesting that there be a full ban on bone meal. That pushed the markets quite a bit lower at the Mercantile Exchange. Over at the Board of Trade, futures in the bean pit, kind of interesting today. The nearbys, short supplies, managed to have a couple 2 or 3 cent rally, but the deferreds, the new crop November on out, they were lower for the day. Let's begin, actually, in the wheat pit, where futures were lower there as well. March contract to 382 high today, a low at 375 and a quarter. A settlement price at 376 in the wheat, down 4.5 cents. May wheat, 387 the high, the low at 381. Settlement price at 382.5, 4.25 lower. July futures for the wheat, 381.5 the high, the low at 377. A settlement price at 377 and a quarter, and they were down 4.25. September futures, 383.5 high, low at 381. A settlement there, 381.5, down 3.5 cents. December wheat futures, 392 on the high, the low at 388.5. A settlement price at 390.5. They finished off 3.5 cents for the day. From the corn pit, the March contract is 274.75 high for the day, the low at 269.25, settled down 2.75 cents in the nearby March contract at $2.70.25 a bushel. May futures for the corn, 279.75 the high, the low 274. Settlement price at 275.25, down 2.75. In July corn, 282.5 the high, the low at 277. Settlement price 278.25, down 2.25. September futures for the corn pit, 276 the high, the low at 272.5, settled on that low at 272.5, down 2.75 for the September. And the new crop December, a 270 settlement price, they were down just 0.75%. The December had a high of 273, a low at 268.5. Again, the settlement for that December at 270 for the new crop, down 0.75%. March corn of 05, 276 the high, the low at 272.25, settled 273.5, they were down 1. And July futures, 280 the high, the low 277. July 2005 crop 277, the settlement price down 1 cent. December futures for 05, this is 2 years out, 252.75 high, low at 252.5, settled 252.75, a settlement price down 0.25 cent. March oats now 156.25 the high, low at 153, settled on that low, down 3 cents. And the May futures 158.5 the high, the low at 155.75, settled on the low, down 3.25 for the day. From the soy complex, March beans 813 the high, the low at 802, settlement price 805.75. They were up 3.25. May futures 811.5 the high, the low at 804.5, a settlement price at 805.75, up a penny and a quarter. July on out were lower for the day, and the July did make a stab at $8, ended at a high at 799.5, couldn't quite make it. So had a low at 791.5 and settled just a half above that at 792, down 3 cents for the July beans. September 714 the high, the low at 705, settled 706.5, down 5.5 cents. New crop now, November, they were off 8.25 cents, 646.5 the high, the low at 635, settlement price 636.5, and the November's down 8.25. January beans 644 the high, the low at 638, settlement price at 638, they finished down 7. March bean meal 249.80 high, low at 246.50, settled 247 even, up 20. In the May meal, 249.80 the high, the low at 246.40, settlement price at 246.50, they were down 40. March bean oil, they finished the day 30.12 the high, the low at 29.78, settled 29.86 unchanged. In the May futures, 30.02 the high, the low at 29.66, settlement price there at 29.76. The May bean oil settled up 4 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today for cattle, mostly lower for lean hogs, and February and March bellies finished higher today. March feeder cattle, 83.80 the high, the low 82.22.5, the settlement 82.22.5, that down the limit, down 150. April 85.40 the high, 83.92.5 the low, and the settlement, that down the limit. May 85.85 the high, 84.35 the low, and settlement, down the limit. August 88.20 the high, 86.77.5 the low, the settlement 86.77.5, that down the limit, down 150. Same story for live cattle. February live cattle 76.45 the high, 74.82.5 the low, and settlement, down the limit. March 72.65 the high, 72.60 low, and settlement, that down the limit. April live cattle 73.05 the high, 71.37.5 the low, and settlement, down the limit. June live cattle 70.15 the high, 68.42.5 the low, and settlement, that down the limit. February lean hogs 59.97.5 today's high, the low 59.20, the final price 59.42.5, that up 50. April 60 even the high, 58.70 the low, 58.87.5 the settlement, that down 47.5. May 60.85 the high, 60.30 the low, 60.65 the settlement, that down 5. June lean hogs 65.10 the high, 64.05 the low, 64.60 the settlement, that down 15. February pork bellies 87.67.5 the high, 86.30 the low, 87.30 the settlement, that up 117.5. March 88.25 the high, 87.30 the low, finishing today at 88.02.5, that up 130. The Dow is down 35 points at 10,470. The Nasdaq is off 46 at 2021, and the S&P 500 is 9 lower at 1127.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ted Ward from Pacifica, California wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, I've been taught that the Earth spins about its axis at about the rate of 700 miles per hour every day, and the Earth spins around the Sun at the rate of 365-day rotations per year. Could all or any of this spinning explain why I get dizzy when trying to write letters or read them?
Sure, the Earth is spinning, the solar system sliding towards some black hole at the center of the galaxy, and even the galaxy is jetting along at some impossible speed away from the Big Bang. So what? You can't spend your whole life blaming outside circumstances for the problems created by your tortured psyche. Inability to read and write are often signs.